Heroes, 1986. For Elizabeth Arthur and Joy Johannesson. For 30 years, I've been fascinated by books about the early explorations of the Antarctic, and particularly by the books written by men who were on the expeditions, Scott, Shackleton, Cherry Garrard, Wilson, Byrd, and so on. All of them not only men of courage and imagination, but excellent writers, vivid, energetic, exact, and powerful. As an American, I wasn't exposed to the British idolization of Scott that now makes it so chic to sneer at him. And I still feel that I am competent to base my judgment of his character, or Shackleton's, or Byrd's, on their own works and witness, without much reference to the various biases of biographers. They were certainly heroes to me, all of them. And as I followed them, step by frost-bitten toed step across the Ross Ice Barrier and up the Beardmore Glacier to the awful place, the White Plateau, and back again, many times, they got into my toes and my bones and my books. And I wrote The Left Hand of Darkness, in which a black man from Earth and an androgynous extraterrestrial pull Scott's sledge through Shackleton's blizzards across a planet called Winter. And 15 years or so later, I wrote a story, Sir, in which a small group of Latin Americans actually reached the South Pole a year before Amundsen and Scott, but decide not to say anything about it, because if the men knew that they had got there first, they are all women, it wouldn't do. The men would be so let down. We left no footprints, even, says the narrator. Now, in writing that story, which was one of the pleasantest experiences of my life, I was aware that I was saying some rather hard things about heroism. But I had no desire or intention to debunk or devalue the actual explorers of Antarctica. What I wanted was to join them, fictionally. I had been along with them so many times in their books. Why couldn't a few of us, my kind of people, housewives, come along with them in my book? Or even come before them? These simple little wishes, when they become what people call ideas, as in, where do you get the ideas for your stories? And when they find themselves in an appropriate nutrient medium, such as prose, may begin to grow, to get yeasty, to fizz. Whatever the idea of that story was, it has continued to ferment in the dark vats of my mental cellars and is now quite heady, with a marked nose and a complicated aftertaste, like a good 69 Zinfandel. I wasn't aware of this process until recently, when I was watching the public broadcasting series about Shackleton, as well conceived, cast, and produced as the series about Scott and Amundsen was shoddy. There were Ernest Shackleton and his three friends, struggling along the abomination of desolation towards the pole, 2 days before they had to turn back, only 97 miles short of that geometrical bindu which they desired so ardently to attain. And the voiceover spoke words from Shackleton's journal. Man can only do his best. The strongest forces of nature are arrayed against us. And I sat there and thought, oh, what nonsense. That startled me. I had been feeling, just as I had always felt, for those cold, hungry, tired, brave men, and commiserating them for the bitter disappointment awaiting them. And yet Shackleton's words struck me as disgustingly false, as silly. Why? I had to think it out. And this paper is the process of thinking it out. Man can only do his best. Well, all right. They were all men, of course, and a long way from the suffragists back home. They honestly believed that man includes women. Or would have said they did if they had ever thought about it, which I doubt they ever did. I am sure they would have laughed heartily at the proposal that their expedition include women. But still, man can only do his best. Or, to put it in my dialect, people can only do their best. Or, as King Yudhisthira says in the great and bitter end of the Mahabharata, by nothing that I do can I attain a goal beyond my reach. That king, whose dog's name is Dharma, knows what he is talking about, as did those English explorers with their clear, fierce sense of duty. But how about the strongest forces of nature are arrayed against us? Here's the problem. What did you expect, Ernest? Indeed, what did you ask for? Didn't you set it up that way? Didn't you arrange, with vast trouble and expense, that the very strongest forces of nature would be arrayed against you and your tiny army? What is false is the military image. What is foolish is the egoism. What is pernicious is the identification of nature as enemy. We are asked to believe that the Antarctic continent became aware that four Englishmen were penetrating her virgin whiteness, and so unleashed upon them the punishing fury of her revenge, the mighty weaponry of wind and blizzard and so forth and so on. Well, I don't believe it. I don't believe that nature is either an enemy or a woman to humanity. Nobody has ever thought so but man. And the thought is, to one not man, no longer acceptable even as a poetic metaphor. Nobody, nothing, arrayed any forces against Shackleton, except Shackleton himself. He created an obstacle to conquer or an enemy to attack, attacked, and was defeated by what? By himself, having himself created the situation in which his defeat could occur. Had he reached the pole, he would have said, I have conquered, I have achieved, in perfectly self-justified triumph. But, forced to retreat, he does not say, I am defeated. He blames it on that which is not himself, nature. If man wins the battle he starts, he takes the credit for winning. But if he doesn't win, he doesn't lose. Forces arrayed against him defeat him. Man does not, cannot fail. And Shackleton, speaking for man, refuses the responsibility for a situation for which he was responsible from beginning to end. In an even more drastic situation, for which he was even more responsible, in his last journal entry, Scott wrote, we took risks. We knew we took them. Things have come out against us, and therefore we have no cause for complaint, but bow to the will of Providence, determined still to do our best to the last. I have seriously tried to find those words false and silly. I can't do it. Their beauty is no accident. Things have come out against us sounds rather like a projection of fault, like the forces arrayed against us, but lacks any note of accusation or blame. The underlying image is that of gambling, trusting to luck. Providence, which is how Scott referred to God, does seem to come in as the other, a will opposed to Scott's will, as nature was opposed to Shackleton's. But something you call by the name of Providence is not something you perceive as an opponent or an enemy. Indeed, the connotations are maternal, nurturing, sheltering, providing. The man may be speaking like a child, but not like a spoiled child. He takes responsibility for the risks taken, and beyond hope, finds duty unalterable, to do our best to the last. Like Yudhisthira, he knew what the last meant. Nothing in me finds this contemptible, and I can't imagine ever finding it contemptible. But I don't know. I have found so many things silly that just a few years ago seemed fine. Time to bottle the wine. If you leave it too long in the wood, it sours and is lost. I don't want to go sour. All I want to do is lose the hero myths so that I can find what is worth admiration. All right. What I admire in Shackleton, at that moment on the barrier, is that he turned back. He gave up. He admitted defeat. And he saved his men. Unfortunately, he also saved his pride by posturing a bit, playing hero. He couldn't admit that his weakness was his strength. He did the right thing, but said the wrong one. So I go on loving Shackleton, but with the slightest shade of contempt for his having boasted. But Scott, who did nearly everything wrong, why have I no such contempt for Scott? Why does he remain worthy in my mind of that awful beauty and freedom, my Antarctica? Evidently because he admitted his failure completely, living it through to its end, death. It is as if Scott realized that his life was a story he had to tell, and he had to get the ending right. This statement may be justly seen as frivolous, trivializing. The death of five people isn't just a story. But then, what is a story? And what does one live for? To stay alive, certainly, but only that. In Amundsen's practical, realistic terms, the deaths of Scott and his four companions were unnecessary, preventable. But then, in what terms was Amundsen's polar journey necessary? It had no justification but nationalism, egoism. Yeah, I'm going to get there first. When Scott's party stopped for the last time, the rocks they had collected for the Museum of Natural History were still heavy on the sledge. That is very moving, but I will not use the scientific motives of Scott's expedition to justify his polar journey. It was a mere race, too, with no goal but winning. It was when he lost the race that it became a real journey to a real end. And this reality, this value to others, lies in the account he kept. Amundsen's relation of his polar run is interesting, informative, in some respects admirable. Scott's journal is all that and very much more than that. I would rank it with Wolfe's or Pepys's diaries as a personal record of inestimable value, written by an artist. Scott's temperament was not very well suited to his position as leader. His ambition and intensity drove him to lead, but his inflexibility, vanity, and unpredictability could make his leadership a disaster. For example, in his sudden decision to take four men, not three, on the last lap to the pole, thus oversetting all the meticulous arrangements for supplies. Scott arranged his own defeat, his death, and the death of the four men he was responsible for. He asked for it. and there were certainly self-destructive elements in his personality. But it would be merely glib to say that he wanted to fail, and it would miss what I see as the real heroism, what he made of his failure. He took complete responsibility for it. He witnessed truly. He kept on telling the story. Unless a grain of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. His self-sacrifice was not, I think, deliberate, but his behavior was sacrificial rather than heroic. And it was as that unheroic creature, a writer, that he gathered, garnered, saved what could be saved from defeat, suffering, and death. Because he was an artist, his testimony turns mere waste and misery into that useful thing, tragedy. His companion, Edward Wilson, whose paintings are perhaps the finest visual record of Antarctica, kept a diary of the polar journey, too. Wilson was a far sweeter, more generous man than Scott, and his diary is very moving, but it has not the power of Scott's. It is not a work of art. It records, but it does not ultimately take responsibility for what happens. Self-absorbed, willful, obsessed, controlling, Scott was evidently an artist born. He should never have been entrusted with a polar expedition, no doubt. But he was, and he had so fierce a determination to tell his story to the end that he wrote it, even as he lay in the tent, on the ice, dying of cold, starvation, and gangrene among his dead. And so Antarctica is ours. He won it for us.